So, you survived the first day. It's always, the first day's tough, isn't it? Boy, like slamming into I don't know, you're going at 100 miles an hour and you crash into stop. It's it just takes, it's going to take a little time to settle in, so don't be too hard on yourself. It's just the way it is. But one thing, it always works. You know, if you can just stay. I mean, part of the main job, I think, for both Dennis and I is to make sure you stay. You know, that's about the big job here, you know? And, one of the jobs I had in my early days in India at retreats was I was the person who, if somebody was getting ready to leave SN Goenka retreat, which was just tough as nails, you know, it was really boot camp Vipassana. And and my job was to talk to them, you know, and see if I couldn't talk them into staying. It didn't work, but I did try, you know. So there's always a little story I like to tell. It's a Zen story to kind of begin retreats and stuff. And so there are these three monks. They're up in the mountains, and they're on retreat, and they're in this little cabin, and there's a lake. And on the other side of the lake, one morning, they decide to go over and sit there. So they all kind of venture over there and sit, and they sit for a while, and then one of them says, "Oh, gosh, I forgot my mat." So he walks across the water and gets his mat and walks back, you know. And then another one kind of gets up and says, "Oh, I was supposed to hang up my other pair of underwear." So he walks across the water, hangs his stuff up, and walks back over, you know. And the third one, he figures this is a test. And if they can do it, he can do anything they can do. So he immediately kind of jumps up and walks into the water and sinks, you know. And he gets out all flustered. And again, he makes the resolve to cross the water. And he steps out, and boom, down he goes again. And quite upset, you know. And so the two monks were sitting there watching all this as he kind of flails and kind of comes out and does it again. And the one turns the other and says, "You think we should tell him where the stones are?" So tonight I thought, you know, what this is really about is somehow about those stones so that we can walk on water, you know. And the fundamentals here are first that, you know, this is a practice which is has been, you know, for centuries and centuries, literally millions of people have woken up. You know, this is not something that we made up that's round or anything. There's nothing new age about this. This is simply a tried and true path. And that it's very well laid out in the sense of the Buddha on the practice of awakening. Because of this, it is said, "This is the only way, O bhikkhus, for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the destruction of suffering and grief, for reaching the right path, for the attainment of nibbana, namely the four arousing mindfulnesses." So, essentially what I wanted to work with, just give you kind of an overview tonight, because I think the practice is, you know, in some ways, it's simple, you know, and that actually when the Buddha talks about the four contemplations or mindfulnesses that exist, in his teachings in the Satipatthana, the kind of the sutta on mindfulness. And it's pretty direct, in a sense. And what's interesting about it is there are kind of many parts to it in some ways. But the truth is that any one of them, fully practiced, will lead directly to liberation. No. So in many traditions, there are many forms of this, but these are the fundamentals, the basics of it, you know. And so the Buddha first in the Satipatthana, he says, you know, go and find a place, really what he's saying is a place that's quiet, that's basically, he talks about the forest in a simple hut, to sit up straight and do these practices, you know. So in a lot of ways, what we're doing here, no, we're not doing the, aren't out in the jungle in a kuti, which I've done a lot of, and you sit. And you, in a sense, contemplate the breath, the body, feelings, the thoughts, and the processes, the dharmas that occur. That's the whole path, you know. And our practice is fundamental. It starts with really some of the simplest pieces. That because we are kind of embodied, and we, you know, sometimes I think we ask for these things, you know. I mean, you may think you just kind of showed up here because, you know, you were born into this accidentally. I don't see it that way. I see that there was a desire, and that desire, it's just like being here in some way. This is not by accident you're here. And sometimes this is part of John's belief system, okay? That we've been doing this, all of you, everyone here, has been doing this for a long time. You know, not necessarily now, but it's been going on and on. Because there's an energetic force that in a culture like this, it's so rare. It's so rare, you know. So, the fact that we are in these bodies, and that these bodies in its simplest form is that, you know, we simply, we have these four postures that we can contemplate, can actually use the mindfulness and the awareness to kind of register what it is that's occurring. Both internally and externally. And it's simply when standing, knowing you're standing. When you're sitting, knowing you're sitting. This is the simplest. And just with this, you can go all the way to awakening. You know, lying down, knowing you're lying down. When you're walking, knowing that you're walking. So the truth behind it is that we have mindfulness, and mindfulness is fundamentally, you know, I like the translation myself of the mind full of the moment. Okay? The mind full of the moment. Now, what's true about that is if you notice from moment to moment, there isn't, you know, there's the remembering of the next moment, but there is actually nothing that happens. You just simply are mindful of a moment. You know? Now, what is it that if we have a series of these moments where we actually, the attention is aware of experience itself, then there is something known as clear comprehension, sampapajana. And that is what's necessary for the mindfulness to actually, in a sense, recognize from moment to moment. You know? And it actually, I think sometimes there's an actual intelligence that when we're mindful, and there's enough moments of it, and there's a clear comprehension. Oh, I'm moving my hand. I'm speaking. You know, all the nuances of our physical experience from moment to moment, and that we begin to recognize them moment for moment. And that clear comprehension is, in a sense, has an intelligence, knowing that whether it's internal or external, whether it's fast or slow, so it actually recognizes what's happening. And so these are the fundamentals that then we take into the simplest of practices. And the simplest of practices, which we worked on this morning, is the breath itself. And simply because one of the things that the Buddha was most interested in was not, in a way, he didn't want to create, I don't believe, he didn't want to create a religion or anything else. What he was looking at was the commonality in human experience that directly took us away from fear and lamentation and grief. And what was that? It was actually that moment of recognition, And in a series of those recognitions, then actually that process can then go to awakening. And so the breath in itself actually contains all of these satipatthanas, these four foundations. It holds it all, Now, it's also true that the reason it's simply picked, the Buddha could have, in the Taoist traditions and some of the Chinese traditions, the heartbeat, You could sit there and just feel your heart, feel your pulse, and know that. And that would be all right, too, because it's, again, you notice of change, you notice of contraction, and you notice of it's really just a process, it's not self, So it's even that is simple enough. But this is something that when the body gets quiet, and that was the teachings, okay, how are we going to look at this? How are we going to teach ourselves? We're going to get ourselves first, the first piece is to still the body, And to still the body, then... one then looks at and feels what is the biggest movement that happens in the body. And simply the breath breathing you, because that's what it's breathing you. And that to actually become aware of the breath breathing you, then in a sense, then one begins to simplify, to uncomplicate both internally and externally, of what's happening, And it's not in a belief system. It doesn't create. It's something that that is universal. Why it was picked was all human beings, no matter what their belief systems are, breathe. That's pretty good, It hopefully can satisfy. Anybody from, when I spent 9 years with Essen Goenken, and in Bodh Gaya, when we would have these big retreats, it'd be like 200 people there. And it was most colorful, because you had up front, you would have the Hindu monks, you'd have the Buddhist monks, you'd have the nuns, you'd have Catholic nuns in their habits, there'd be Jesuits, there would be, it was really very cultural, of all the belief systems. The Jains were there, and what was it was that was true was that this was something taught that was not based on a belief system, was based on actual experience, and it was something that was universal in all beings. So the breath, in essence, in the Zen tradition, and some of the traditions, not just in the Soto particularly, it is the sole practice. It's just sometimes it's just counting the breath, or just being with the breath was enough. And it's true that that is enough. Now, one of the truths is that the breath is part of what? It's part of the body. So as we begin to put attention on the breathing, we begin to notice the fundamentals here. And the fundamentals is that it's happening in a body. And so, in essence, then we begin to, in a sense, experience or contemplate or know the body in its both internal and external experience. And in the Satipatthana, probably what is the most described are actually practices of the body, you know. And I personally will include the breath as part of that, even though it's not held so much as that. But it is, you know. And so our practice here is we turn our attention, then in a way this is in a complete system, is to then go from the breath to the body. And the body can be contemplated in, there's a series of ways that are in the sutta. One of them I like is, my teacher said, is moving from the head to the toes, and from the toes back up to the crown of the head. That is just becoming really, in a sense, it's a method that's used a lot of times in a lot of the MBSR work of Jon Kabat-Zinn, and also in the in Ubha Khin's work out of Burma. And it can be very helpful. Again, you can take that all the way to awakening. There's also the contemplation of the four elements, which I like very much. It's more of a Burmese practice of just recognizing the fire element, the earth element. And these are just, you only have four things to name: earth, air, water, fire, you know? And so when we actually relate to it and experience it, then it's simple. We just simply, instead of being with breath, we name what element is being noticed. What are we mindful of in that? You know, there's also the practice, I don't know, you may describe some of the 32 parts of the body, which is one of the Burmese monks I was with, Thongpulu Sayadaw, and that was his really sole practice. He would say, you know, in a way, it's kind of a memorization. You go through these 32 parts of the body, you say them over and over and over and over and over and over. But his description was that as you begin to actually take the words to where you experience in the body, that in that, then one begins to see that this is just parts, you know? This is just parts. And the parts are not I, me, or mine. They're simply these processes that are impersonal. And what's miraculous to me is in the 32 parts of the body, is that, which we usually never look at because this is very much an internal practice, is the fact that what you're experiencing is, you know, something that we kind of run over or use. And this is something that actually says, oh, you know, these areas of experience, you know, are mysterious, you know? I mean, we are kind of these miraculous things walking around in you know, saying, oh, we breathe. But there's all these functions that are going on. And what do you do about these functions? Is there anything you do about them? You know, I don't think so. You know, they are actually, in you could say, self-organizing. And that they organize, they keep you well. You know, you get sick, and actually it's amazing how we heal, the body can heal from a regenerator, or whatever you want to say. It's miraculous it can do that. You know, you think of chemo, and it, you know, it's kind of, it kills you, and then that's good brings back, you know. And amazing that it can do something like that. So there are also what are known as the nine charnel ground practices, you know. And it's something in the West I don't see You know, my grandparents, owned a funeral home in Kansas. And so when I was a little kid, well, I won't tell you the rest of it. Anyway, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, for kids, you had to go in and you had to poke and check it out and kind of go, you know, what is this, you know? These kind of cold corpses. And in the charnel ground practices, though, it's a whole process of, and it's particularly used for young monks, by the way, is due to lust, is they kind of see the temporalness of the body, that it arises due to causes and conditions. It also disappears, you know, and just becomes a corpse. You know, I mean, I saw a lot of corpses when I was little, but I think the first time I was about 15 or 16, and I was spending the summer in Egypt, and my sister and I were going out to the pyramids, and we had to stop, all these people were around and stuff, and there was a canal there, and there was a dead body that they brought, and it was all bloated and blue and black, and you know, it was maybe, I'd been touched by all that stuff in the funeral home, that they kind of take all the blood out and then they put formaldehyde back in. And it looks, you know, okay. But this was something else, you know, and in a sense kind of shocking. And oh, can that happen to me, you know? And it is part of the truth of those contemplations, you know. So the practices of body. So the four satipatthanas are principally body, which includes breath. There is vedana, which is feeling. There is kind of a mental consciousness. And there is the processes of dharma. You know. So those are the fundamentals there. Now, vedana is probably, to me, it is kind of a crucial in our experience. And vedana simply means feeling. And feeling in this terminology simply means that experience of either pleasantness, unpleasantness, or non-pleasant or non-unpleasant. So it's those three categories, you know. Sometimes we say neutral, but I'm not sure that's such a good word. It's really non-pleasant, non-pleasant, non-unpleasant, you know. And that's the flavors that when we get really settled and we're with the breath and we're kind of embodied in some way, then we begin to turn our attention, which is incredibly important because it is really, in the Buddha's teachings, the kind of the origin of what he calls dependent origination was all based on this vedana, you know, and that at that juncture of experience, you know, most of the time it's interesting how we name things, and this is one of the complexities of all this, is we actually name things like, oh, I'm happy and so I have pleasant sensation, but if you actually are very awake and clear what is being experienced, there's maybe, oh, let's say you get really good 8 moments of pleasantness, okay, and then there's a bunch of non-pleasant, you got 4 or 5 of those, and then in that you also get unpleasantness, and even in kind of the most you know, the best chocolate, the best food, whatever, it still exists there because it's not one thing, you know. And yet if we get a certain amount on one side of it, then we actually, this is where grasping occurs. And so what do? You know, we actually reach out of the present towards that pleasantness, not recognizing that even in the pleasantness, there is unpleasantness. Now, what's interesting, it's another thing that is one of the really the gifts of this practice, is that when there's a series of unpleasant moments, whether it's body sensation or an emotion or thought, what happens? You know, there is some means of either dissociating or moving away from it. Instinctively, this is just it's instinctual experience, you know, and we don't like it, so we move away from it. But if we have the wherewithal and we're actually quite mindful of what it is that's appearing moment to moment, we'll find out that even in the unpleasantness, there are moments of unpleasantness, moments of pleasantness. And so that is really where the kind of investigative quality of all this comes, because we start breaking down kind of the solidified belief systems and forces that have kind of held us around these. And so we actually are beginning to, bring some intelligence directly to experience. A lot of times I think this is the Satipatthana is the juncture that these other pieces are important, but this is the place, this is the kind of that place between ignorance and awakening, you know. And that if we recognize it and aren't caught by the grasping or the pushing away, then there is this possibility of recognizing freedom, you know. And this is the juncture, you know. And the Buddha was very precise in this. He you know, they're kind of the 12 stages of dependent origination. But that place where contact and feeling happen, right there is the door to awakening, you know. And so we become, this is why this takes so much work and time, because we have to slow this whole complexity and storytelling and all the discomforts and movements and everything down to where we actually can slow it down enough to see the truth, you know. And the truth is about the grasping, you know, grasping for or against whatever arises. You got it? You know, I'm sure, you know, I'm not doing anything new here. I'm just, you know, it's the same old, so it's okay. But I have to remind you, you know, simply because, you know, we forget. We even forget why we're here, you know, a lot of times. You know, what the heck did I do? You know, 10 days, you're kidding me. But I can assure you, you know, that even sometimes, we get slow enough to where we actually notice the unpleasant or pleasantness, and we release it for a moment. And in that moment, if there is enough wherewithal, we have intuitive insight. We have a moment of deep understanding, you know, which begins to, even without you knowing it, it begins to build on itself and work on you. You know, and that's it's kind of Thich Nhat Hanh calls it the miracle of mindfulness. Well, that's kind of it. It's just suddenly we've noticed, and we didn't even know we really noticed, and yet we change because of it, because it's happened enough times that we're no longer buying the old reaction, you know, and seeing that we actually have some means of choice in our experience, you know. So, the third of these is simply the truth around what we know is mental formations and emotions, you know. And a lot of times in our instructions, we like to separate this out between thinking and emotions. But in the Satipatthana, they're actually one thing, you know. And meaning probably they just perpetuate ignorance, you know. And so again, it's a job of waking up to know, you know, to be awake and aware that when there's, you know, when they talk about when there's lust in the mind, you know that it's there. Or if there's fear in the mind, you know it's there. Or there's desire in the mind, you know it's there. And so, so much of the Vedana, the actual feeling, then when it exaggerates somewhat, then it goes into these primal feelings that then become emotions and thought processes. Because, you know, which came first? The what's the chicken or the egg? You know? And it's hard to say, you know? Because was it the thought or was it the feeling, the emotion? You know? And then how, do they just dance together? It seems like they do, don't they? You know? And to actually see into them, to actually get, oh, you know, that the feeling and the thought, they're happening so rapidly and dancing that I don't have to worry about separating them out. What I need to know is that they are based on ignorance and they create some kind of, excuse me, stupidity, you know, and we act foolishly. Or we kind of get it and go, oh, you know, I see how the thought and the feeling, they come together, and I'm using feeling emotion here, that they kind of come in unison in some way, kind of play off each other. And that's really this third foundation, you know, and particularly around the emotions, but also, you know, as I said last night, the Ajahn Buddhadasa, or this morning, I don't remember when, he just was asked about the world and, you know, what was causing the trouble in the world. And he said, simply said, lost in thought. And if you didn't notice that today, then, you know, you had a really good day. So, I mean, these are they're very fundamental pieces. But as we begin to recognize, in a sense, we're kind of studying this operating system. And it's possible to understand and experience what freedom is in the midst of all this, you know. The fourth of the Satipatthanas is it traditionally it just talked about as the dharmas. And I think of them as the way the Buddha set up simple understanding through very clear processes. So he starts out with the five hindrances, you know, of desire and anger and sloth and torpor and in my brain here, and
restlessness
and worry and doubt, you know. And these are, in a sense, are kind of entrapments. And they come, and one of the beauties about concentration is that it has the nature to push the hindrances aside, which is one of the gifts, so you don't get so hung up with that stuff. But in the sense of knowing is to know how these hindrances kind of grab us and, you know, we suffer for them. You know, that's really the bottom line. We just suffer for them, you know. And that so to just to know them and recognize them as they too are impermanent in nature. To get caught in them is to suffer. And they are not personal. They are simply impersonal processes. And then I was trying to remember what, how the anyway in order there, which I don't. I'll find them. The second of these is the five aggregates, you know, which I don't know if it's a good word for it. You know, there's been a question about that. The five, you can also call them the five streams, you know, and the five streams are really our individual process that happens, you know. And so there's form, there's feeling, there's perception, there's mental formation and consciousness. Those are the five aggregates. And the truth about them is these are just the building blocks of human being, right? It's simplistic building blocks. And they are not you. No. And that was really the piece that the Buddha was trying to say. These are processes, you know, that there is form, there's which body, there is perception, there's feeling, perception, mental formations, all the stuff we make up. And then there's consciousness. All of this, if looked at very closely, is simply arises and passes away. You know, and the consciousness itself is, in the sense, the kind of knowing factor that connects with them at different levels. You know? But all of it is impermanent phenomena. You know, all of these aggregates. And not who you are, it's in a sense what you are. And then, which is important, we'll talk about all these things, little bits of them, is the six senses. You know, and again, to be awake and mindful to the six senses is there's seeing, there's smelling, there's tasting, there's hearing. There is body sensation and there's thought. You know, that's the whole game. You know, and again, the idea is to know them as systems. You know, the systems is there's an eye and there's the seeing. And so ultimately, you know, the Dalai Lama has this thing of where he was down. I always say this, but I'm probably a little off. He'd probably go after me for this, but it's okay. That he spoke of the 18 kinds of emptiness. And what he was referring to was actually that the six consciousnesses, of, so we know eye, ear, those are the six, and then there are the organs that experience them, and then there's the consciousness that knows them. 18 kinds of emptiness. How's that? You know, now you can get very complicated with this. I'm just trying to simplify it for you so, you know, you won't suffer so much around all this stuff. You know. So, and there's kind of two more that are identified in the Satipatthana Sutta. One is the, which is, to me, it's the seven factors of awakening. And they are fundamental principles of, first of all, with mindfulness, and then it's the balancing factors, you know, that we have investigation, energy, and joy on one side, and we have then tranquility, concentration, equanimity on the other. And if we can learn to balance this, you will be awakened. How's that? You know? But again, I know first night you're listening to a lot of words, and you know. But I'm throwing it all at you because you got to get over it, you know. And then we'll get it down to little pieces, you know. So the last of these is, of course, the Four Noble Truths, you know. You know, there's the problem. There's the what. The diagnosis, the prognosis, and the treatment, you know, and that was really what the Buddha was teaching. Very scientific, you know, in the sense we know there's suffering, we know there's in the nature of being. In our confusion, there's a problem, and that the Buddha simply said, "Oh, that's based on grasping, clinging," you know. So we have to study that. Oh, do you do that? You know? And if you do, you suffer. And if you actually learn about it, you let go of it. And if you let go of it, then the kind of third noble truth there is freedom exists. Awakening is not something, you know, I think sometimes we think, oh, it's for somebody else. And our job is to say that's not true. You know, this awakening is actually for you, here and now. It is not something to aspire to the future, but actually to recognize that inside, this very being sitting here, you know, that all the factors exist, and that it's in a way, we separate ourselves out. But if we can actually remember, you know, in a sense of the world of non-struggle, the world of kind of fearless openness, that this freedom, this awakening, exists in you here and now. You know? So it's not something in the future. You know? I'm not saying there isn't the Big Bang Theory about the future and all that stuff that is written about and in all these schools, but the truth is, you have it. You know, it's here if you choose it. You know, and that's really the bottom line here, is if you choose it. You know, and then there's the path. You know, the Eightfold Noble Path, and that's the stones to cross to cross the waters. Really, you don't have to fall in. And those Eightfold Noble Path, you can walk on water, and you won't keep falling in. So I'm going to end here with this is a poem that I wrote. This was in the spring, and I was out on the deck. I was teaching at Spirit Rock. And I went out, and the grass was, you know, it was like, you know, it was probably over a foot tall. And there, I was just looking out, and suddenly all the grass started moving, and there were these little turkeys. What do they call turkey? Little turkeys?
Poults.
P-O-U-L-T-S.
Poults? Yeah. So, anyway, this is called Mindfulness. Where was I? Dancing on some distant past. Hoping, believing in this reminiscing could ultimately change the past and empower the future magically. Oh no, there I am, messing with my life again, giving myself a headache, believing in some ultimate solution. What kind of balderdash is this? Knowing somehow this is not the practice. Tiger chasing its tail. Going in mental circles endlessly, trying to outthink my own thinking. How much simpler could it be? Letting go of one's thought constructions? Mind full of this holy presence? Weaving forgetfulness with this remembering. Suddenly, the little baby turkey chicks, weaving themselves through the windy tall grass, illuminating the joy of the one who is fully present, having known what to do all along, knowing what to do all along, yielding everything to the present. Let's just sit for a moment.